So we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Chaf Tet Amud Aleph, 12 lines down. We left off yesterday with the discussion with regards to the tension between Chilul Shabbat, the necessity to keep Shabbat, versus Pikuach Nefesh, danger to one's life. And over there, the Gemara had different formulations as to what we do on behalf of a woman who's giving birth. And then the Gemara concluded with, we go like the person who is Mekil in the formulation here because of Safek Nefashot HaKel. When it comes to issues or matters of life, there we are more cautious and we err on the side of doing the right thing in order to preserve life. And therefore, it's Safek Nefashot HaKel. Rashi in other places says that it's based on Bitzilu Aida, that is the command to bait in, to do whatever is possible to spare the life of an individual. And so too over here, we do whatever is possible to spare the life of the individual. The dispensation, as we saw in the Gemara yesterday, begins with Tchivchat HaKever, at the time the woman starts to give birth. And that'll be the discussion in the Gemara today. When does that moment happen? What is the threshold by which we consider a woman to be giving birth, that she then is granted that dispensation? We also saw that the dispensation with regards to a woman giving birth is broader than simply matters that are life and death for her, but things that are for her psychological well-being are also important and classified as pikuach nefesh, and therefore anything that will make her calmer or relax her or make it easier for her to give birth, all of those are included within the framework of what you're allowed to do on behalf of this chola, on behalf of this woman who is giving birth. There is a famous story with regards to Rab Chaim Mibrisk, famously known to be Mekil with regards to Chilul Shabbat when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh. And so his family asked him, why are you always Mekil with regards to Chilul Shabbat, when in many other areas of Halacha you always go to Hachmir? And so he answered them that I'm not Mekil in Chilul Shabbat, but rather I'm Machmir in Pikuach Nefesh. And so in this area also, I'm Machmir. When it comes to life-threatening issues, that we take the precautions and we do the proper things to save the person's life and to ensure that they are taken care of properly. So that's the beginning of the framework here. You have to know that there is a parallel Gemara in Yoma that deals with this as well, but over there it's dealing with fasting rather than with the, as Tosafot discussed yesterday, psychological issues of the women as well as any other matter that we're dealing with here. Over there, the Gemara discusses what happens if there is a tension between the woman and the doctors. In general, we say that the doctors will trump, meaning that if they think she needs something and she says she doesn't, we will generally listen to the doctors because she may not be completely of sound mind now because of the pain and the trauma she's undergoing, and therefore we will be mechalel Shabbat based on the doctors. Vice versa, if she wants something and the doctor says she doesn't, there the poskim, the Rishonim, deal with what we do in those situations. But generally, in time periods or proximity to where the woman is in danger, we generally do listen to her. We try to placate her in a way that it will maintain her psychological well-being during that time of trauma. So now the Gemara asks, when does this all start? When does she get this status of a yoledet or a chaya, as the Gemara calls it over here, in order to be granted these dispensations? And that's what the Gemara says, Mematai tichat hakever. When does the kever, which is the rechem, the womb, considered to be open so that she's granted those rights? Amar Abaye, Mishasha teisheva l'mashber. The moment she sits on the birthing stool or the birthing stone, that already is the time period where we assume that she's considered to be a chaya, and then all of these dispensations kick in. Rav Huna Breda, Rav Yeshua Amar, Mishasha dam shutet v'yored. It's the time that the blood starts to flow and drip out of the woman. It's not clear here from the Gemara whether that is prior to the time that she sits on the birthing stone or stool, or afterwards. I mean, that is this the kula? I mean, it's an earlier time or a later time? Mishabura discusses this in the Bir Alocha as to whether this is a larger kula or a bigger chumrah. Damri law, and some say, Mishash chavrotea nosot oto ba'agafa. And some say it's when her friends have to help her, meaning that she's unable to walk on her own because she's already beginning to give birth, and therefore they have to help her, agafa, her wings, but her arms. They need to support her when she is walking. And if that's the case, that's already considered to be that she's in the birthing process. And as we said before, since this is safek pikuach nefesh, we go to hakel, that means that any one of these items, if she shows signs of any of these items, she's considered to have p'tichat hakever, and we will be mechalel Shabbat on her behalf. Ad matai p'tichat hakever? Until when does this status last? I mean, that's the beginning of the process of birthing. Until when does she have that status of a woman giving birth? Amar Abaye, shloshe yamim. For 3 days after the birth, she's granted that status of a woman giving birth, and then we are mechalel Shabbat for her. Rav Amar Mishmei de Rav Yehuda, shiva, for 7 days. V'amri la, shloshim. And some say that is 30 days, as we're about to see now, that maybe they're not necessarily arguing, but speaking about different thresholds, which is Amar Nardai. The Nardai say, chaya, gimel. Zayin v'lamed. A woman who gives birth has different statuses as she moves through these time periods. For the first 3 days after she gives birth, 7 days after she gives birth, 30 days after she gives birth. These are natural cycles that we know from other areas of halacha, including getting married, sheva brachot, avelut. These are parts of those cycles that also have meaning in terms of milestones within people's lives. And so to over here, these are milestone periods of time. Gimel, from the time she gives birth until 3 days, ben amra tzrichani, ben amra lo tzrichani, or the other gear says lo amra tzricha. She doesn't say that I need it. Mechalalin et haShabbat, or mechalal Shabbat. So this is similar to the formulation that we saw yesterday, where we do this for her, whether she says she needs it, she doesn't say she needs it, whether she articulates or doesn't articulate it. If it's something that most women in that situation would need, we do it for her without even asking or without her asking for it, because this is the most dangerous period of time. This is when the pikuach nefesh is most apparent, and therefore we take care of her. Mechalel et haShabbat. Are any questions? Zayin, Amra, Srichani, Mechalel et haShabbat. From the third day until the seventh day, if she says she needs something that requires Chilul Shabbat, then we're Mechalel Shabbat for her. Amra lo Srichani, E Mechalel et haShabbat. If she says, I don't need anything, then we're not Mechalel Shabbat for her because she says she doesn't need it. Again, here, if the doctors say that she does need it, then we would generally listen to the doctors because we don't necessarily believe that she's of sound mind to say whether she does or doesn't need this particular item. And if it's something that the doctors feel is necessary, we generally listen to the doctors and be mechalel Shabbat. Lamed, from the seventh day until the 30th day, afilu amrat zrichani, even she says, I need it, ein mechalelin at haShabbat. Then we're not mechalel the Shabbat for her, because we assume already at that time she's past the point of danger. And since she's past the point of danger, we're not mechalel Shabbat, because we're only mechalel Shabbat when it's sakanat nifashot, when there's a life-threatening issue, because pikuach nefesh is doche Shabbat. But just being sick in general is not a threshold that allows you to be mechalel Shabbat. But in that case, avalosim ayidei armai. But you can't do it through a non-Jew. As Rashi says over here, you can do direct amir liakum. You can say something directly to the non-Jew to do on her behalf. Kidravula bredrav ilai damar. Kol tzarchei chole naseh ayidei armai. Any needs or things that are necessary for the chole can be done by a non-Jew b'Shabbat. It's similar to what Rav Nuna said, davar she'ein bo sakana. When there is no sakana, omer le'nachri v'oseh. Then you say it to the nachri, and he does it on their behalf. So as Rashi points out over here, that a woman in the first 30 days after birth has a stam, default status of being a chola, she'll be a chola she'ein bo sakana, that's not in danger or life-threatening danger, and therefore she has the right to have these things done for her, ayyadei nachri. And that is with regards to Shabbat. We have different categories of individuals who are sick that allow for different dispensations. There's a chole sheyesh bo sakana, a chole or chola that has life-threatening problems. In that situation, as Rashi says over here, we don't wait for a non-Jew to come to do it, but rather Yisrael atzmo se'ata, that the Yisrael himself does it on their behalf. The Gemara in Yoma notes that it's important that the Gidolim and the Chachamim do the Chilul Shabbat to demonstrate to the people the importance of Chilul Shabbat for Pikuach Nefesh. So number one, it should be done by even the best or the biggest guns should do it in order to indicate to the Hamonam that that's the proper behavior in this situation. Number two is the Shulchan Aruch says that the reason that we do that is because we don't want any delay in the Tipul and the taking care of the individual. That leaves open a window, which the Rama notes, that if there's no delay by having a non-Jew do it, then maybe you should ask a non-Jew to do it, because if it's an option between Chilul Shabbat and no Chilul Shabbat, maybe it's better to do no Chilul Shabbat if you get the same outcome and with the same response time so that there's no delay. In general, we favor using the Armai, using a non-Jew, when there is no delay or there's no degradation in the treatment that's being afforded to the individual. So that is a consideration when it will not take any delay or will not cause any problems to have a non-Jew do it. But absent that, a Jew does it. We're mechalel Shabbat when there's a chola sheyesh bo sakana. With regards to a chola that has sakanat eiver, over there is a machloket amongst the Rishonim. It's based on a girsa and the Tosafot, as well as a me'iri that was found later, as to whether sakanat eiver has a din like sakanat nefashot, and therefore we would be mechalel Shabbat or do whatever we need to do for the individual. Or is that solely or uniquely associated with eyesight that the Gemara connects sakanat eiver to sakanat aguf, and therefore that has ramifications with regards to things that are not sakanat haguf kulo, or the life-threatening, but they are limb-threatening. Then we have another category, which the Gemara nents over here, which is chole she'en bo sakana, someone who's sick but is not life-threatening. In those situations, there are dispensations to violate Dinei Derabanan, including Amir La'akum, which is asking a non-Jew to do a Isur Doraita on your behalf in order to treat or take care of the individual. And there, a Jew can violate even a Din Derabanan if there is Sakanat Eiver. If there's not Sakanat Eiver, then only through a shinui can they violate a din derabanan on behalf of the chole shein bo sakana. And then there's something called the michush ba'alma, which is a person who doesn't have a sakana, no danger, not even that they're chole, they're not necessarily sick and no fel de mita, where they are now bedridden because of whatever sickness or whatever ailment that is plaguing them, but they have like a headache or something's bothering them. Over there, we have even less dispensations in terms of the individual. There we have some room to move because of the tsar or the pain that's ruining their oneg Shabbat, but we are less likely to allow you to violate Dinei Derabanan in terms of taking medication, unless you're nofel b'mita, because the pain is so overwhelming. If that's not the case, then the only thing you can do is take items that healthy people would consume that also happen to have medical benefits to you, but you can't take medicine directly because you haven't reached that threshold by which we would allow you to violate that din derabanan of taking medication on Shabbat. So there are these different strata of categories of severity by which if you rise in the severity, then we have bigger dispensations for you in order to take care of the chole on Shabbat. So here, with regards to the woman who's giving birth, in the first 3 days, she's definitely a bisakana, and therefore everything is allowed. From 3 to 7, if she needs it, or the doctors say she needs it, then she's bisakana, and we allow you to deal with it. From 7 days to 30 days, then we assume she's a chola, she ain't bosakana, and therefore we use, or we invoke, Amir la'akum, to allow you to treat the individual violating Dinei Doraita, but using a non-Jew to do that, or possibly a Jew can do it to violate Dinei Derabanan, depending on what type of Din Derabanan it is and what ailment it is and whether you need a shinoi in order to violate that Din Derabanan. This threshold of 30 days by a chaya, what's so important about it? I mean, if she's a chula, she ain't bo sakana, yes, she has that default status until 30 days, so that is helpful up to 30 days. But even after that, if she's a chola she'en bo sakana, she'd have the same status even after 30 days. So what is the threshold of 30 days important for? Amrei naradai l'tvila. That's to say when she can go to the mikveh in order to be mitaher herself from the leida. So not like today where we're choshesh when a woman has pichat hakever that she's yoledet bezov, and therefore she can't get a tahara because she doesn't have a cessation of dam until much later, and therefore she can never get shiva nikim in order to become tahara. So it can take months afterwards for her to become tahara. Back then they were not choshesh for that, and therefore they had dam tohar, which means after a week for a male, after 2 weeks for a female, then any dam she sees after that would be dam tohar. And if she went to the mikveh, she'd be tohara, both for taharot, as well as to her husband. The question that Rabbi Yehuda posed was, what is this 30-day threshold? And the Naradai indicated that it has to do with when's the earliest time she should go to the mikveh. Amarava lo amran elashein bala ima. That's only if her husband is not with her. Of a bala ima, if her husband's with her, bala mechamama, then her husband can warm her up. What you see from Rava's statement is that the problem of going to the mikveh is that this woman is weakened by the birthing process. She's at risk. There are dangers. She goes to the mikveh, she will become cold from going into the cold water, the freezing cold water, or entering the mikveh. And if she's unable to warm herself up, that could be dangerous to her. So they say wait until 30 days where her body is sufficiently recovered so that if she goes to the mikveh, it won't be detrimental to her. That might both be from the problem of open wounds as well as the cold, as Rava is noting over here. But if she has her husband with her who can warm her up, meaning that he can be together with her and keep her warm in bed, then she has a built-in heating element that will keep her warm even if she's gone to the mikveh, and then it's not a problem. And brings a case of this, kahad brati de Rav Chista, like the daughter of Rav Chista, who was the wife of Rava, tavla begotlatin yomin, she went to the mikveh within 30 days of giving birth, shalo bifnei bala, when her husband was out of town, bitstaneya, she became freezing cold, she was shivering from that, vamtuye la arsa batrei de Rava de Pumpadita, and they carried her on her bed after Rava, where Rava was, in Pumpadita. You know, they took his wife to him in order to have him warm her up so that she would not be in danger. So you see from this that that threshold of 30 days is connected to the husband. If the husband's there, then the husband can provide the warmth that the woman needs. If the husband's not there, then she should wait until after 30 days in order not to be in danger of getting cold or weakness of her body being affected by going to the mikveh. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, osim midura v'chaya b'shabbat. You can make a large pyre, you can make a fire for a woman giving birth on Shabbat. Savar mina, we thought to say that this statement of Rav Yehuda is l'chaya in l'chola lo. That's for a woman who gives birth, but not for a regular person who is sick. Bimota gishamim in. We thought that also would only apply to the winter time. Bimota chamalo, not in this summertime. And the Gemara has one version here, which is taken out of the Girsa, which is that's not the case. It doesn't matter. Or we have a new statement, which does the same thing, which is itmar. Someone who let blood, nitztanein, and now they're cold, osim lo midura, afilu b'tukavat katamuz. You make for them a large pyre or fire in order to warm them up, even in the summertime. Even in the hottest time of the year, you still make them for a fire. So you see from that statement that there isn't a limitation with regards to this. It doesn't matter what time of year, doesn't matter what type of choleh, irrespective of either of those factors, if they need it, and it's danger to their life, you can even do it on Shabbat in order to warm them up. Shmuel, Tzalchule Taka Deshaga, they broke up for him a chair or a stool that was made out of teak wood, so that was something that was expensive, and yet they still broke it up in order to give him firewood to make a fire to warm him up after he was given blood. Rav Yehuda, Tzalchule Petora Deyavna, they broke up for him a table that was made of juniper wood. Rashi says it's a type of cedar, and then he brings from his Rebbe that it is boish, which is, according to the Bach, atze brutim, or it's a bok, which is beech wood, but it's a expensive table, and they didn't, again, have firewood, so they chopped up this table in order to make him firewood. Rabu Tzalchule Sharshifa. They broke up. Rashi says here it's a safsal. Or the Aruch Skirsa is Shraf, which is a stool or a footstool in order to him to have firewood to recover from the letting of his blood. Ramalei Abaye, who's a Talmud of Rabu, says to Rabu, Balkaver Mar Mishum Bal Tashrit. Isn't this wasteful? You're taking these expensive items, you're taking these kelim, destroying them just to make a fire to warm up. The well-being and the health of my body is adifli, is more important to me. I mean that Baal Tashchit is with Kelim, but there's also Baal Tashchit with regard to one's health. And therefore you see from here in the Gemara that taking care of one's health is a din d'oraita that has an Isur Lav associated with it, not just an asay, which is Ushmartem Me'od Nafshul Techem, that you have to take care of your well-being and your health and protect yourself, but also it's Baal Tashchit. You're not allowed to destroy. You're not allowed to do things that are detrimental to your health because it's a violation of here, Baal Tashchit. Rabba says back to him that, yeah, here, Baal Tashchit of Kelim and Baal Tashchit of my goof takes precedence. And since over here there's a danger to my well-being or my health, if I don't get heat after I give blood, it's better to destroy this furniture and burn it in order to have the heat rather than to be at risk that I don't have the heat to keep my health after I've given blood. So, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Lo Olam Yimkor Adam Korot Beito, Vikach Menalayim LeRaglav. Person should even sell the beams of his house, I guess the roof over his head would be the expression, in order to have shoes for his feet. Rashi explains over here, Shein Lecha Bizuim in Amalech Yachef Bashuk. There's nothing more beneath the dignity, embarrassing for an individual than to go barefoot in the shul. That's something that's considered to be unacceptable, or something that shows the tremendous poverty that that person is suffering. And therefore, one should even sell the roof over their head in order to have shoes on their feet. Hekiz Dam. A person who lets blood and has nothing to eat, Yimkor Min Alayim Shibaraglav, but yes, speak Mehem Tzarchei Suda. He should sell the shoes off his feet in order to provide the means for a meal that he can have after he's given blood. And so what you see from here is how important it is to eat after one has given blood, so that even the thing that is most important for you to spend your money on, which are shoes, you would sell those in order to provide for the means of a su'uda, a meal after you've given blood. Mai tzarchei su'uda. What is the basic need of a su'uda? What do you need to eat after one has let blood? Rav Amar Basar. Rav says you got to eat meat. Shmuel Amar Yayin, and Shmuel says wine. Rav Amar Basar. Rav says that meat is what you eat after you've given blood. Nafsha Chalaf Nafsha. Because you've now given your blood, which is Ki Nefesh Ko Basar Damahu. Or we have other psukim. Yadam Hu Banefesh Yechaper. The comparison or the correlation between the dam of an individual and the nefesh. And so a person who gives blood is giving up of their nefesh, so they in turn ingest or eat meat, which is the quote-unquote nefesh of the behema in order to replace the nefesh that they lost. Ushmol amar yayin sumka, you should drink red wine, chalaf sumka, because you lost blood that was red, so you want to replace it by drinking red wine. So you had a diminishment in the life force of the individual, and you want to replace it. And we've seen before in the Gemara that eating of meat, the consumption of meat, is considered to be something that's healthy, something that gives life force to the individual. And similarly, we saw that the Gemara also focuses on color, that if something is lost of a certain color, then replacing it with this colored item or a similar colored item should also help the individual. In their day, it was very popular to let blood. That was both for medical reasons, meaning that they thought there was health benefits to it, as well as the fact that people felt, quote-unquote, heavy, which means that they were lethargic. They also thought that letting blood was a way to lighten the individual's load, lighten the person, and therefore make them less lethargic. And so they did it both as a preventative measure in dealing with lethargy and other heaviness that they felt, as well as they used it for medical reasons. And so now the Gemara is going to speak in that context of the medical side of letting blood. What are the proper procedures and framework in which to do it? Shmuel, b'yom ha'avad milta. Shmuel, on the day that he used to do, milta means this thing, or this word in the Gemara, it's a code word for letting blood. Avdilei tavshila detachle. They used to make for him a dish made out of spleen. As Rashi says over here, the spleen is red. And so therefore you're eating both the basar and something that's red. And so therefore it was efficacious to eat after one had let blood. Yochanan shati adanafik tiaya miune. He used to drink seemingly wine until the aroma of the wine used to exit his ear, meaning that he used to drink a ton after he had given blood. Rav Nachman shati ad kafei tachle. He used to drink until his spleen began to float. Rav Yosef shati ad nafik miribda de kuslita. He used to drink so much until it exited from the cut that the bloodletter had let. It started to exit from there. These are expressions or exaggerations that they used to eat or drink a lot. Rava mehadar achamra bar tlata tarfe. He used to look for wine that was three leaves. Rashi says that that means that it was aged 3 years. Shitana imo, that its mother had already given for 3 years. Mishinikad gimel alim chadashim. But it already has three new leaves. Now, that could mean that the grapes that were used were grapes from the third year of the production of this vine, or it could mean that the wine itself, as the Rashi suggests over here, aged for 3 years, meaning that the vine that you took it from aged or had three more years of growth after you already took the wine from here before you drink the wine. So that's aged for 3 years. Either way, you use this type of wine that had a certain potency to it that was then helpful after you gave blood. Amalu Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, the Rabbanon. So Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak says to the Rabbanon, Matuto minaychu, I beg you, b'yom ha'dahakozo, on the day that you give blood, Amru lebitaychu, say to your wives, Nachman iklo legaban. Rav Nachman's coming to visit us. Now, he's suggesting that they say this because if Rav Nachman's coming to visit, they're going to set up a big meal, they're going to have plenty of food that's available and drink that's available because they're expecting a special guest. And even though he wasn't coming, they would do that, and then they would be available for these individuals who let their blood and needed that seuda. So therefore, they were allowed to tell a white lie in order to have this food available for them. And that's what he says here. Bekulu arume asire. Any artifice or deception is improper. Bar mihai arama deshori. With exception of this deception that is permitted, and that is, number one, what he already just said, plus what he's about to say now, which is mandavid milta. Someone who had their blood let, Elo Efsharle, and he doesn't have the means by which to get the wine that he needs to drink afterwards or the meal he needs afterwards. Lishko Zuka Mako, he should take a coin that Rashi claims is not accepted by anybody, meaning that's a worn down coin that is not accepted by merchants anymore. Others suggest that it's accepted Ayyudei Dachak, it would be accepted in a difficult situation, but they normally would not accept it. Lezel Leshev Chanuta, he should go to 7 different stores, at the time Shur Reviyata, until he's able to drink a revi'it worth of wine. Meaning that he'll go into each store, and he'll get a taster, implying that he's going to buy, then he'll hand him the coin, and he'll say, oh, we don't accept that coin here, and then he'll have to move on, because they won't sell it to him. But in doing the tasters in all these 7 stores, he will accumulate over that time the amount that he needs of revi'it yayin. And even though it's a deceptive practice because you are leading the person into believing that you're going to purchase it, even though you can't or you're not going to purchase it, nevertheless, in this situation where it came to the issues of health, he allowed this form of deception because technically You do have the money to pay for it, but the chanut, or the storekeeper, is not going to accept the coin. It's a little easier according to those that say the coin would be accepted on your day of the chak. Rashi says it wouldn't be accepted at all. It really is a much bigger deception. But nevertheless, because there are serious health risks to this individual, he permitted harama, and the harama, or the deception, increased. In one case, he's just doing it with his own family, and it's his own money that's being spent. The other case, he's doing it with the storekeeper, so another person is affected by it as well. Now, it is only a taster, it is a small amount, but it's still nevertheless something that would be considered unacceptable had it not been for the health risks that were involved if he didn't do this, and that's why he permitted it, but he only permitted it in that situation and in no other situation. Bimlo. And if not, Lechel Shev Tavre Uchmata, he should eat 7 black dates, but he should Mishcha Bitzid'e, and then he should anoint oil on his temples, Vinigane B'Shimsha, and then he should sit out in the sun to warm up. So all of this, drinking, eating, or the process that was just mentioned here, are to warm the body, because the body is weakened and becomes cold after the blood is drained or taken out of the individual. Avlat, which is the name of a non-Jewish individual, Ashche the Shmuel, the Gani B'Shimsha, he saw that Shmuel was laying out, resting in the sun. Amarle, Chakima, do you die? How could it be that the wise man of the Jews, Bisha, Miyavatava, the sun or the heat of the sun, which is detrimental to the individuals and the health of the individual, how could it be good? And why are you sitting out in the sun? Amarle, Yoma da Kozuhu. Says that it's a day that I gave blood, and therefore I needed to warm myself up, and therefore there is benefit, or it is beneficial to sit out in the sun. Belohi. But that wasn't the truth, because Ela Ika Yoma Demali Bashimsha Bekule Shato. There is one day a year where sitting out in the sun is beneficial. Yoma de Nafla Beit Kufat Tammuz is one version of it. The other one is Nafla Beit Kufat Tevet. It's either the winter solstice or the summer solstice. Sitting out in the sun on that day is beneficial. Hisabar Loiglile. But he didn't want to disclose that. Whether he didn't want to disclose that because he didn't want to give away this good secret that he had that was beneficial to this non-Jewish individual, and therefore he kept it to himself, or whether he thought that it was somewhat problematic because it was something that was a skula. It wasn't something that was medically or empirically good. So he said something, or he told him something that was empirically or medically clear, which is that if you go to give blood, then you need to warm up, and therefore the sun is beneficial. And he didn't want to tell him, he didn't want to reveal to him that he was really doing it for a different reason, which was this gula, this positive aspect of the sun, which comes about in the spiritual realm when one is in the sun, whether it's on the summer solstice or the winter solstice, depending on the girsa that you have over here. Ravu Shmuel, the Amrei Tavayo, call him Mekio Besudat HaKazat Dam. Anybody who doesn't take seriously eating after one has given blood or had blood taken from them, Mekilin Lo Mizunotav Min HaShamayim, then they also are reducing his parnosa, his ability to feed himself Min HaShamayim, because it's a Midah Keneged Midah. Omrim, Hu Lo Al-Chayav Lo Chas. He doesn't worry about his own life when he goes through this procedure, which is somewhat dangerous, and you need to mitigate it by eating, and he doesn't take care of himself. So Hashem says, why should I then care about him? If he doesn't care about himself, why should I care about him? So if he doesn't eat properly at that time in order to strengthen or take care of his body, Hashem says, I'll do the same. I won't take care of him as well, and therefore I will not provide his mizonot. Once again, here you see this idea of putting a premium on a person's health, that a person has to be careful about their health, because the way that you treat your health is the same way that it will be reflected. Midah keneged midah, Hashem will take care of your health. Rav Shmuel de Amrei Tarvayu, Haiman de Ovid Milta, Lo Leitev Hecha de Korech Zika. Person or individual who lets blood should not sit in a place where the wind can be felt or it's windy. Dilma Shafile Umna, because there's a possibility that the Uman, craftsman in the code words of the Gemara, is a bloodletter, someone who is an expert in these matters. Many times, as we'll see later, it also was connected with the barber or the cutting of one's hair or the shaving of the hair, but he would let the blood, umukim le'a reviata, and he was careful to take a blood but leave a revived blood in the individual. Gemara believes that that's the minimum amount of blood that a person needs in order to survive. So he had taken out blood and left him just a sufficient amount to live. Batizika v'shayif minei. And then all of a sudden a wind will come and cause more blood to come out. Batilei sakana. And now he'll be endangered because he's now continued to have blood letting from his body even after he's reached that threshold of a revi'it left, which is base amount of blood that he needs in order to survive. Rashi notes that a person who has had blood let from them and left a ravine, they shouldn't sit in a place where there's turbulence, where there is wind that comes around and swirls around, because it could cause more blood to be let from the individual, and that would endanger them. Shmuel Avarogiel Bavin Milta Bebeita, he used to, when he had his blood let, he would sit in a house, the Shav Levinya Baricha, in a house where the bricks, the layers of bricks, the width of the walls was comprised of 7 bricks. Levena is a full brick, Aricha is a half brick. I mean, very thick walls by which it stopped or stymied any wind from getting in there, and therefore he wasn't in danger when he used to do that. And as Rashi explains over here, that each brick is 3 fachim, and a half brick is 1.5 to fachim wide, where the thickness of the wall was Sheva Livanaya, 7 bricks, Barichaya is a half a brick, so it's 7 layers times 3 is 21, plus an Arichaya, which is another 1.5 tefachim, it was 22.5 tefachim wide thickness of the wall, and therefore it was protective, it was a place that was shielded and a good place to give blood. Yom Echada Avad V'Ergish B'Nafshe, and one time he did let blood in there, and he felt cold or he felt weak in this house. Madak, he checked, V'Chasar Chad Aricha, and he saw that one of the half brick layers was missing, and therefore he was sensitive to the fact that then there was some air movement or lack of stillness in the air, and that was causing him to not feel well. Rabbi Shmuel Damrei Tavayo, Amanda Ovid Milta, Lito Midei Vahadar Lipuk. A person who has bloodlet should first taste something, eat something, and then go out. Dilo Toy Midei, because if he doesn't taste anything and then he just heads out, Ipaga Bishikva, he bumps into a corpse, Yarkape, his face will turn green. Ipaga Amanda Kotol Nafsha, if he bumps into a person who was a murderer, meat, then the individual that blood will die from seeing the murderer. Ipaga B'Dovar Acher, if he bumps into a Chazir, as Rashi explains over here, Kasha L'Dovar Acher, that's negative or has impact on him in terms of Tzorat. And as Rashi claims over here, Chazirim Nugaim Heim, because the Chazirim themselves carry or are infected with Nigaim. As the Gemara in Kedushin says, that Yud Kabim Negaim Yardud Olam, there were 10 portions of Negaim that came down to the world, and 9 of them were given to the Chazirim. This relates to something that we discussed in the Gemara Nidah and in other places, that there is a belief in Chazal that the things that you see have a deep impact on the individual at crucial moments, whether that's B'Tashmish Amita, or over here where the person is very weak after they've been giving blood. Here, if they see a corpse or they see a murderer, it'll have a deep impact on the individual, or seeing the chazir that is plagued with tzorat will be influential on the individual and cause them to suffer the fate of whatever those individuals are. Rabbi Shmuel Darmei Tavayo, Rabbi Shmuel both say, I'm on the Ovid Milta Lishai Purta Vahadalekum. After you've let blood, one should wait a little bit before quickly arising. Damar Mar, Hei Dvarim Krovim Lemita Yoter Min Achayim. There are 5 things that put you closer to death than life, and we'll enumerate them here. Achal v'amad, person who eats and then suddenly jumps up. Shata, someone drinks v'amad and suddenly jumps up. Yashen, someone who sleeps v'amad and suddenly jumps up. Hikiz dam, someone who lets blood and then jumps up. Shishmei shmitato, someone engages in marital relations v'amad and suddenly jumps up. All those are negative or detrimental to the individual. And we see over here advice that is somewhat akin to what we do today with regards to giving blood. When a person donates blood today, there's a certain amount of weakness that they feel afterwards because of the giving of that blood or the donating of that blood. So they first ask the person to remain in the lying position to ensure that they're not lightheaded and that they can slowly recover from the giving of the blood. Then after they get up, arise from that, they tell them to drink something that's sugary, drink something and eat something in order to strengthen the body and ensure that they can move on and slowly allow the body to rebuild. And they tell you not to engage in heavy exercise in other manners that would somehow affect the body because there is a weakening of the body. As you see, a similar type of advice that's being given over here with regards to someone who let blood, that they need to eat, they need to drink, and they need to make sure that they don't jump up after they have let their blood. Amar Shmuel, Pursa de Dam Aklo Tratim Yom. The interval of giving blood, or a normal interval of giving blood, is every 30 days. Ubena Prakim Yima'et. As he gets older, he should reduce it. Ubena Prakim, as he gets even older, Yachzor V'Yima'et. He should reduce it once again. Rashi explains over here, that is, the Prakim are 20-year intervals. From the age of 20 to 40, he should have his blood let every 30 days. After he crosses over 40, from 40 to 60, he should cut it in half. Instead, he should do it once every 60 days. And then, once he reaches 60 and older, he should once again reduce it and do it once every 90 days instead of once every 30 or 60 days. He'll do it every 90 days. That's the way Rashi reads it. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Chananel explains over here, which he quotes as a Masorah from his Rebbeim, which is that the maximum amount of times a person should let blood when they are young is once every 30 days. Ben HaPrakim, according to him, is when you reach the age of 50, you should start reducing that interval, and that you should do it every 2 or 3 months at maximum. After that point in time, which he doesn't give a threshold, but at further advanced age from there, then he should reduce it again and do it once every 6 months or once a year. Meaning as the person weakens, he needs to do this less and less because of the weakening effect on the individual, the ability of the body to reproduce or replenish the blood that's there. And that's true today as well when a person donates blood, that the intervals that we say for younger people, they can have shorter intervals. For people who are older, they have larger intervals. In different countries, the thresholds are 60 days or 90 days in terms of donating blood. So it's a similar type of interval in terms of the body's ability to replenish and return to its former strength before you take it away. And again, as a person gets older, it becomes harder and harder for that replenishment, or that weakness is more impactful. And therefore, you would do it less and less, or would be more reluctant to take blood or let blood in those situations. Rama Shmuel, person of the Dhamma. In addition, Shmuel tells us that the times to have blood let are Chag B'Shabto, Arba U'Mali Shabto. It's to do it either on Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. Aval Sheni V'Chamishi Lo. But on Mondays and Thursdays, that's not a good time to let blood. Damar Mar, Mishesh Lo Zchut Avot, Yakiz Dam B'Sheni V'Chamishi. Someone who has lots of merits, has great yichus, he can give blood on a Monday and Thursday, meaning that it's very dangerous to give blood on a Monday and Thursday. And the Gemara explains why. Because whenever the courts down below sit to adjudicate, so do the heavenly courts sit to adjudicate. And as Rashi notes over here, from the time of Ezra and onward, he instituted that the courts would sit every Monday and Thursday, the days of the Shuk. They would also have the courts be open so people could come to court when they were coming to the Shuk. And therefore, Monday and Thursday is the Din days down below, meaning in the earthly courts. And that is reflected with a din in the heavenly courts. And Rashi over here makes a note that this seemingly is according to the one who says, Adam Nidon B'chol Yom. A person is judged every day. It's a machloket in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah as to whether a person is judged on Rosh Hashanah or a person is judged every day. It seems to be Rashi here is leaning towards that opinion that a person is judged every day. And since the Bati Dinim sit on Mondays and Thursdays from the Takanat Ezra and onward, and it's a day where they have Yom HaDin U'Pkidahi, Avonutav Niskarim. So hence that's a Yom HaDin, then of course Baruch Hu looks into the matters. If you're ready up for judgment or issues of judgment, then Hashem takes a look to see whether you're really meritorious or not. And therefore, if you put yourself into a position of vulnerability, it's risky when there is judgment going on because they could come out negatively in the judgment. You don't want to take risks at a time where you are vulnerable. Now, Tosafot points out, before Takanat Ezra, when the Bati Dinim used to sit every day, then when could you ever let blood? She says, even before the time of Ezra, they didn't sit every day. They sat when it was necessary. So it wasn't that there was any day that was kavua to sit, or they weren't there every single day. They came or they opened up when there was necessity. Therefore, there was no particular day, and that's why before that Takanai wasn't an issue. But since Takanai Ezra, Monday and Thursdays are more dangerous days, and for that reason, we have the long Tachanun, and we ask for more Rachamim on Mondays and Thursdays, as well as the fact that you should avoid these more dangerous activities on Mondays and Thursdays. But Talata B'Shabta, my time lo. So then, why can't you give it on Tuesday? You explain to me why you can't give on Monday and Thursday. You said the days you can give are Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. What about Tuesday? Why can't you give on Tuesday? So he says, Mishum dekaima la ma'adim bizuve. Because on that day, ma'adim, which is Mars, is bizuge, is on a even number. So therefore, it's doubly dangerous. This relates to a Gemara that we saw back at the end of Gemara Brachot. And I will send out a chart that'll make it easier for you to see so you can follow along what I'm saying here. But the Gemara over there, and Rashi explains there as well as over here, that there are 7 planetary bodies that are considered to be connected with a particular hour of the day, and they move every 7 hours. They go through their cycle. There are 2 acronyms that Rashi notes over here. One is Katsnash Chalam, which is the order of these items at the beginning of the nighttime, meaning the beginning of the halachic day. And then there's Chalam Katsnash, which is the acronym for how they associate with the beginning of sunrise on a particular day, the first hour of the day. Which one of these mazalot is, as they call here, sholet, has its power or its time period. And so that is actually how we get the names of our days of the week. And we went through this when I did in the Gemara in Brachot, that the Chalam Katznai stands for Chama, which is the first day of the week is Sunday. Then Livana is the second one, which is Monday, which is Moon or Lundi, Lunar. Ma'adim, which is what we're speaking about over here, which is Mardi in French or Tuesday or the Nordic gods. Ma'adim is Mars. Then Wednesday is Kochav, which is Mercury or Mercredi in France. Sedek is on Thursday, which is Jeudi or Jupiter. Noga is on Friday, which is Vendredi or Venus. And Shabtai is on Shabbat, which is Saturday or from Saturn. That's actually what determines the names of the week. And so what the Gemara is pointing out over here is that Tuesday, Ma'adim, is the one that is Shalat at the beginning of the day, the first hour of the day. So it's Ma'adim's day. And Ma'adim, Mars, as we're going to see later on in the Masechta, the end of Masechta, the Mars, which is the red planet, is associated with blood, with death, with Cherev, Dever, Puraniyot, negative things. And the Gemara will say later on also about professions that are involved with bloodletting are also associated with Mars. And that is the constellation or Mazal of Mars. On Tuesday, it's Sholet in the first hour. In addition, the Gemara in Arvei Psachim, the last parak of Psachim, speaks about this issue that is really only found in the Talmud Bavli, not in the Yerushalmi, an issue of Zugot, which is that there are dangers with even numbers because the Shedim, the demons, survive or thrive on things that are of even numbers. And therefore, we try to do things in odd numbers or odd manners. So when you have a coalescing, a union of Mars, which is this negative planet because of the redness, that is associated with an even number, those two things together make it dangerous. And as it turns out, that Ma'adim, when it's the first hour of the day on Tuesday, that means that the next time it appears, because there's seven of these planetary objects that are cycling through every 7 hours, then when you reach the eighth hour of the day, which is an even number, Ma'adim will be in that eighth hour. So then you have a union of or coalescing of an even number with Ma'adim with Mars, and therefore it's a very negative item. So that makes it a dangerous day to let blood because of that negative association with an even number and Ma'adim together. We'll defer discussing the issue of Zugot until Arvei Pesachim, which we'll try to discuss it more about what the origins of it are, why we don't necessarily worry about it today, and try to get some understanding of it. So we'll defer that discussion to then. But that is why we exclude, or we say that Tuesday is not a great day to do it. So the Gemara says, wait a minute, then Male Shabtanami Kaim Abzave. Also on Friday, it turns out to be on an even number, because Ma'adim falls out then on the sixth hour of the day on Friday. That means you have an even hour on the day where Ma'adim is Sholeit. And so it should also be problematic on Friday. So Mar says, came into Dashu Beirabim, since the public at large had decided that that's okay to do it, Shomer Pitayim Hashem. Hashem watches over those that are foolish. So as Rashi explains over here, this had to do with their poverty. And it's a situation that we see raised in the Rishonim many times, and then in the halachic literature, which is that they did many things on Friday because of the Sudat Shabbat. They're already investing money to eat a bigger Sudat Shabbat or to have a better Sudat Shabbat. So many times they would double up with some other simcha to use that Sudat Shabbat as a Sudat for something else as well. So in this instance, they would use the Sudat Shabbat also as a Sudat that you need after you let blood because you need a bigger suda. So if you did on Erev Shabbat, you would be able then to kill two birds with one stone. You'd be able to both eat a meal for Shabbat, which would be a bigger meal, and eat a bigger meal that you need for letting of blood. They also used to do weddings on Erev Shabbat because of that reason, so that the wedding meal would be the Shabbat night meal. And again, they didn't have the means or the ability to have so many big meals and celebrations. They were clearly impoverished, and therefore they tried to use Friday as a day for doing many things where they could use the Shabbat meal. And as the Rashi says, Hugalo mipnei dochakan, they were under extreme poverty because of the difficulties, shiyu krovim l'sudat Shabbat. They used to try to do it as close as possible to Sudat Shabbat. So even though it is a dangerous thing, came into Dashu Beirabim, since the general public has decided that they're going to ignore the danger associated with it, then for Shomer Ptayim Hashem, Hashem protects based on that. The Gemara invokes this principle also in Yevamot with regards to certain women. It would be dangerous for them to become pregnant. And yet the Chachamim say that they don't mishameshet b'moch. They don't use some sort of birth control to protect themselves. As well as with associated with the Brit Milah, doing it on certain days, the problems or the dangers involved. In all of these cases, Gemara says, came into Dashu Beirabim, since the public at large has decided that they're going to do this or ignore the dangers, Shomer B'tayim Hashem. Hashem guards or takes care or secures those that are foolish. The question is, when do you invoke this principle of Moshe Feinstein? Before, I think he really understood the issues of smoking, invokes this principle with regards to smoking. Even though there's danger in smoking, he says, Shomer B'tayim Hashem, because everybody does it, and therefore Hashem will protect them. I think that was before he was aware of the real medical problems and detriments to the health of an individual from smoking, where it was not just a Dashu Bei Rabim and Shomer B'tayim Hashem, where there was real damage that was done to the individual. I think it had it been explained to him in that way, he would have had a very different outcome, like many of the Gedolim after him. But over here, we have what needs to be a balance between a certain amount of risk that people undertake, as well as the ability to protect oneself from danger and from things that are problematic for your health. Rav Chanan Wasserman in the Kol HaTzaharot tries to bring a balance between these things and says that when you engage in activities that everybody engages in, which are normal activities, even though they involve risk, that's when we invoke the principle of Kenevin Dadashu Bei Rabim or Shomer B'tayim Hashem. Whereas when you engage in activities that are inherently risky, that either are not necessary, or there are things that can easily be prevented, or things that you don't need to engage in that risk and still be able to conduct yourself in a normal manner, those are things where we say that you have an obligation to take care of yourself, an obligation to protect yourself against these problems, and therefore you cannot engage in these activities or they are problematic. So the examples that I give all the time are to drive in a car, getting into a car, or getting on a plane are dangerous activities. There are people, unfortunately, that die from fatalities from crashes, both in plane crashes and in car crashes. But again, it's considered to be a normal activity. Everybody goes, it's a part of the normal life, it's an activity undertaken by people in the normal courses of their life. And therefore, in those situations, we don't say, don't get into a car. We say, came into Dashu Bei Rabim. That's the way that people in general conduct their lives. In the day of the Chachamim, they did it with animals, and there was danger that an animal could gore you or could hurt you. But nevertheless, since this was the normal activity and the normal way that people conduct themselves, there we invoke the principle of Shomer B'tayim Hashem. Now they have to get into a car and not put on a seatbelt, or to get onto a plane and not follow the procedures or safety precautions. That's something that is not necessary and something that can easily be prevented from undertaking that risk without impairing the person's ability to do what they want to do. Similar to getting on a bike without a helmet. A person who gets on a bike can ride a bike, even though they're dangerous with riding a bike, assuming they do it in a safe manner, because it's normal activity that people engage in. It's not something that is extraordinary in its risk that's being undertaken. But then to ride a bike without a helmet, that is something where the risks are clear that you endanger your life significantly, and there's no impairment by wearing a helmet that can give you all that safety and that protection without having to do anything extra. So again, you have to find that balance between them, and that's what the Gemara says over here, that the world at large has decided that it's important for them to do it because of their financial situation, to do bloodletting on Friday so that they can partake or take advantage of the Shabbat meal. That makes it that Kedashu Bei Rabim, that's a normal risk that's now undertaken by people. If it's a normal risk, you can also undertake that normal risk, and then we invoke the principle of Shomer P'tayim Hashem, and therefore people give blood or let blood on Fridays, despite the fact that there is Madim found on an even number on that day. And even though, as Rashi points out, there are other instances where you have an even hour and Madim falling out, but those are at nighttime, and at nighttime people don't let blood, so they're not impactful in terms of it being a negative day for one to engage in letting blood. Tosafot also adds that the fact that late on Wednesday, there is an even hour that coincides with Madim, but it's so late in the day that people aren't going to let blood so close to nightfall. Amar Shmuel, Dalet du Dalet, a Wednesday that falls out on the 4th of the month. Dalet du Arbesar, if you have a Wednesday that falls out on the 14th of the month, Dalet du Esrim Be'arba, or a Wednesday that falls out on the 24th of the month, then all those are days where one should not let blood. Dalet du Leka Arba Batrei, and a Wednesday which has less than 4 days left to the month. That's one explanation that Rashi brings. Sakanto, all of those are dangerous days on which to let blood or give blood, and one should avoid giving blood or letting blood on those days. Rashi brings a second interpretation, is that it's a Wednesday that has no other Wednesday remaining in the month. Rashi rejects that explanation, and Tosfot explains why he rejects that explanation is because Wednesday that falls out on the 24th is a situation where you will not have another Wednesday left in the month. So that's the equivalent of saying that. If you did it on a Wednesday, which has no Wednesdays left in the month, it's equivalent to doing it on the 24th. Truth is, it does depend on how long the month is. But either way, they reject that alternate explanation. Rosh Chodesh, Visheni Lo, the first day of the month, and the second day of the month, Chulsha, is a days where a person is weak and should not engage in this activity. Shlishi Lo, on the third day of the month, Sakana. It's dangerous to let blood or give blood on those days. Male Yom Tova Chulsha, on every Yom Tov, it is weakening or it's not beneficial to give blood on those days. Male Yom Datserta Sakanta, on Erev Shavuot, then it's dangerous, life-threatening to let blood on those days. And the Chachamim were gozer every other Erev Yom Tov because of Erev Shavuot, and that's why they say Chulsha by the other days, because they are not necessarily dangerous, but they don't want people doing it because they don't want them doing it on Erev Shavuot. What's the problem on Erev Shavuot? The Nafik Beis Zika, Ushmei Tavuach, because a wind that comes out that is called Tavuach, the slaughtering wind, Dilo Kable Yisro Torah, Habotavuch Lu, Libasrayu, Ulidamayu. It would have slaughtered them, it would have taken their basar, their flesh, and their blood, meaning that it's a day that is at risk. It was the day, as we saw earlier in the Masechta, back on Daf Peichet, that Yom HaShishi, that Hashem was waiting till the 6th of Sivan to see if Bnei Yisrael would accept the Torah. If they accepted the Torah, fine. If not, then he was going to machzir maseh breshit, the Tohu Vavohu. Or when he holds the har over them and says, if you accept the Torah, fine. If not, shamtei kvuratchem, this is going to be your burial place. So it's a day of tavoach, or riskiness. It's interesting to note that Chazal termed the day after Shavuot as Yom HaTavoach, the day of Shechita, because it was the day that they brought korbanot of Shavuot that are doche Yom Tov, but are not doche Shabbat. So if Shavuot fell on Shabbat, Sunday was known as Yom HaTavoach, which over there has to do with the Shechita of the korbanot. But it's interesting to note that the same terminology is used over here. The Mishnah Berurah explains that the Tavoach was not a wind, but rather a shade, a demon that would come and kill Bnei Yisrael. Either way, because of the danger associated with that day, it's an inauspicious day to let blood because of the quote-unquote danger or the nature of such a day. And everyone should avoid letting blood on that day because of the danger involved. Amar Shmuel, Achal chita v'kiz dam. Someone who eats wheat or flour or bread, lo hikiz, elo ta chita. Then if they let the blood, they're only letting out that which he just ate. Meaning that once a person ingests food, especially heavy items or carbohydrates and starches, they make a person feel heavy and tired. And so then when you let blood afterwards, all you've done is remove that heaviness associated with that eating. But it doesn't then have any efficaciousness with regards to your general health. That's only if you're doing it for medicinal purposes. But it's lightening you, then it does lighten you. It does make you feel less lethargic, even if you do it after you've eaten. Megiz dam, shtiel alter. Person who lets blood should drink immediately afterwards. Achila ad chatzi mil. You should eat within a half a meal, which is roughly 9 minutes after you've let blood. Once you drink, you should drink immediately, but after that it's detrimental. Or maybe afterwards it's not detrimental, it's not efficacious. Take it, we don't know. You should eat until a chatzi meal. That's beneficial. Before then or after then, kashi is detrimental. Or maybe it makes no difference. It's not detrimental. It's not efficacious. Teiku, once again, it's an unresolved issue. So now the Gemara continues. Machriz Rav. Rav used to announce, Mea Korei Bezuza. If you can buy 100 gourds for a zuz, then maybe you should buy them. Mea Reshe Bezuza. If you can buy 100 heads of animals for a zuz, then maybe you should buy them. Mea Sfame. If you can buy 100, maybe mustaches, lips, below klum, they're not worth buying no matter what the price is. Rashi claims over here that the problem with these items are that these are not healthy items. These aren't things that are efficacious in terms of both their health benefits and seemingly in the context that we're speaking about over here, they're not helpful after one has let blood. These are not going to help the individual to have a suda on these items. So only if they are super cheap and you get tons of them, maybe then it's worthwhile expending the money to use them. But otherwise, they're not worthwhile to invest in. And certain of these items are not worth it at all. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Chananel has an alternative view here in terms of what this means. He says, Mea Reshe is talking about the barber. The barber cuts 100 heads for a zuz. Now, the question is whether that means each person pays him a zuz, or he cuts 100 people's hair and gets a zuz. And then on top of that, mea carne is the girsa that he has over here. Not gourds, but carne, meaning horns. Horns were the tool of trade for the bloodletters. So the 100 bloodlettings, bizuz, is worth a zuz. But svamo, when it comes to trimming the mustache and the beard, below klum, you don't get paid for that. So what the Rabbeinu Hanano explains over here is that you pay for the haircut, so you pay for the shave and the haircut, you pay for the bloodletting, but as a side or as a benefit for paying for those services, you get the trim of the mustache and the beard that comes with it. And so therefore, the person who works or does this for a living, he will get paid for the bloodletting, he will get paid for the cutting of the hair, but he will not get paid for the trimming of the mustache and the beard. And again, here, that was what we saw earlier, that there was an association between the barber and the bloodletter. It seems to be that since they worked with knives and they used sharp instruments, that a person got their hair cut and their bloodlet simultaneously, or the same individual was the uman that practiced these things, and therefore it's a package deal that comes along. Amar Rav Yosef, Yavinan Beirav, Peyvena Beirav Huna, Yomad Befagre Beirabonan. Rav Yosef says, when I was at Beirav Huna, it was a day that Mefagre Beirabonan. It was a day that the Rabbanan were either lazy or they were weak. They were unable to review their Gemara or their learning. It was a day that was not so productive in the Beit Midrash. Amre, so Rav Huna said about this, Eidna Yomad Desfamehu. This is the mustache day. I didn't know what they meant. Obviously, it's a reference to what Rav had said about Me'asfame Velo Klum. That when you have 100 mustaches, it's not worth, according to the way Rashi explains, it's not worth a penny. Meaning that it's a worthless day or a lost day to learning because it's not productive in any way. Or according to the way that the Rabbeinu Hananel explained it, it's a day where the individual works, but he doesn't get paid because this is thrown in. It's a day when he cuts the beard, trims the beards and the mustaches, but he doesn't get paid for that because it comes along with the package deal with the other items. So that's what he meant here. Yom de Mefagre Bei Rabbonon, a day that they were lax the days ago, they were weak, it was a day that was not so productive. He called it a Yom HaDesfame, which Rav Yosef didn't understand what it meant, but the Gemara is bringing in the context of what Rav said, because that's obviously the reference Rav Huna was making to his Rebbe Rav's statement that Yom HaDesfame meant something that is worthless or something that is not productive in any way. All right, V'koshrim HaTibur, it says in the Mishnah that one of the things that you're allowed to do on Shabbat, Mimichalal Shabbat for the birth of babies, is to tie the umbilical cord. So Tan Rabbanan, we have a bright, similar to what we saw in the Mishnah, Koshrim HaTibur, you're allowed to tie the umbilical cord. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Af Chotchim, you're allowed to cut it. V'tomnim HaShaliyah, Kedei She'echam HaVlad. And then you bury the placenta in order to warm the Vlad. So in the Meiri, he brings, this is seemingly a skula based on the Gemara in Yerushalmi that says that there was a practice or a minhag to bury the placenta after the birth of the baby. And it was seen as being a beneficial to the baby. Here it's saying to warm up the baby. The way that Yerushalmi seems to indicate is because the Torah tells us that a person comes from the afar, vela afar tashuv, and then returns to the dust of the earth. So this is a pikadon. This is as if you're giving a deposit for that which in the future the person will return to afar yashuv. So you placate the earth by giving them a pikadon now so that the baby can survive or can live now. That was the concept behind the burying of this shiliah. Obviously on Shabbat, you can't bury because you can't dig into the ground. So what they used to do is, I remember Shimon Galil, the princesses used to submerge the shiliah, the placenta, into vessels containing oil. The wealthy women who were not princesses, they used to put it into sponges of wool. And the poor women used to put it into their worn down clothing rags that were soft. And then they would keep it there until after Shabbat, and after Shabbat they would bury it. So they were able to keep up this practice without actually literally burying it on Shabbat for the benefit of the Vlad. And this is seen to be efficacious enough that we allow them to do this even on Shabbat. Again, here there's no violation of Shabbat because you're not digging into the ground, but still the fact that we allow you to engage in the activity because they see it as being beneficial to the warmth or the survivability of the baby. The halacha is like Rav Yossi, that not only can you tie the umbilical cord, but you're allowed to sever the umbilical cord so that the placenta does not remain attached to the baby. If you have twins that are born, they agree to Rabbi Yossi that you cut it, shechotchim, that you sever the umbilical cords, because if you don't sever the umbilical cords, if they're attached to a single placenta or somehow their placentas are connected, they could end up tearing themselves away by turning in different directions, because in a sense they're competing individuals and they could do different things and move in different directions, and that could cause a tearing or rupturing of the umbilical cord if you don't cut it off. And therefore we want to sever it so you don't have that problem. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avuah, Amar Rav, Kol Ha'amur B'Parshat HaTochecha. Anything that's said in this parsha of rebuke, it's not the parshiot of Tochecha in the Torah, but the parsha of Tochecha that's said in Yechezkel, Em Osim L'Chayav Shabbat. That which is rebuked, that Yechezkel's telling, is supposed to tell the people that Hashem did this for you, and you ignored all this goodness that Hashem bestowed upon you, that is something you're allowed to do for a woman who gives birth on Shabbat. It's told what it says over here, Lo Mikra Malfik. This doesn't come out of the Pasuk. These aren't Limudim from the Pasuk, Ela Mistoma. Even Shabbat, a parsha Tochecha, if it comes in the parsha of rebuke, as Rashi says over here, Tochecha is litvakeach uludia mishu sarach al shekinegdo. It's to quarrel with, to make known to someone the misdeed that they did to injure this individual, to make it known to them. So that's what it says. That shows you that Tochecha is involved with tsar. There's some pain or difficulty that's associated with that Tochecha if you don't do it or if you don't take care of it. So therefore, the Chachamim were makil with these items to say that you're allowed to do them on Shabbat because there's no Isur Doraita. And since they involve Tsar, which is what the Tochecha is saying, that if you don't do these things, then there is Tsar and Hashem did this for you and you still aren't thankful to that. It's something that we give a dispensation to a woman who gives birth, Shenemar, because it says, the remainder of which might be actually familiar to you from the Haggadah or from a Brit Milah, which it says here, Omod otayech b'yom huledet otach lo charat sharech u'b'mayim lo ruchatz l'mish'i v'amleach lo humlachat v'achtel lo chutalta. As when it came to your birth, when you were born, was your navel, your umbilical cord wasn't cut. You were not bathed in water to smooth you out. You were not rubbed in salt, nor were you swaddled. Lo chas alayech ayin masod lach achat me'ela lo chumla alayech. No one had enough pity on you to do any of these things that normally were done for a child and have compassion on them. Tushlechi al pnei asadeh b'goel nafsheich b'yom uledet otach. You were thrown, left lying to waste and rejected in the open field. V'hor alayech v'erech mitposeset b'damayech. And I passed by and saw you wallowing in your blood. V'omer lach b'damayech chayi, v'omer lach b'damayech chayi. And I said, you're going to live in spite of your blood. And I said to you, you're going to live in spite of your blood. I mean, that Hashem came and grabbed you, but you see that this is what's normally performed for a baby that's born. And the fact that it wasn't done was upsetting and was dismaying. And therefore Hashem intervened in order to save you. And this is the Tochecha to Bnei Yisrael, that despite the fact that Hashem interceded on their behalf to save them, they still did not return the favor and act in a manner that was becoming of someone that was indebted to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what he did for them. And that's what Gemara explains now. Modotayach v'yom huledet mikan shemiyabdim et avlad b'shabbat, that we help or we facilitate the ability v'lo charat sharech, and was your navel not severed or cut mikan shechotchim et tibur b'shabbat, like Rabbi Yossi, you're allowed to cut the umbilical cord on Shabbat. They learn it from a pasuk sharech hagana soar, which is found in Shir Hashirim. U'b'mayim lo rachatz b'mish'i, you were not bathed and cleaned in water, mikan shechotchim avlad b'shabbat, that you're allowed to rinse off or wash the baby on Shabbat. V'hamleach lohum lachat, and were you not salted, mikan shechotchim avlad b'shabbat, that you're allowed to salt them. So as Rashi explains before, that the waters are used to wash off and clean the baby, the mish'i, latuach lachlik b'saro, in order to baste and to smoothen out his skin. And then the salt is put on in order to harden the skin from its softness. V'hochtel lo chutalt, were you not swaddled? Mikan me'lafifim avlad b'shabbat. And from here, we see that you are allowed to swaddle the baby on Shabbat. As Rashi points out, that this is distinct from that which we heard on Kuf Chaf Gimel, that you're not allowed to be a suve yanoka, that you're not allowed to do or straighten out the limbs of the baby on Shabbat. There, Rav Nachman said it was asur, because here is only the Fufe, and Badam Tosavot on Kuf Chaf Gimel Amud Aleph notes that distinction, because earlier back in B'mei Isha and our Gemara over here say that you're allowed to wrap or swaddle the baby and put them into a vimple in order to have them be swaddled and held together properly. But Rav Nachman over here, who says that the Asuve Yenoka is Asur, is something more extreme, That is to straighten out the limbs, to put them in place and to seat the limbs properly. That's not allowed on Shabbat. That's already considered to be too much of a mitakin on Shabbat, and therefore Rav Nachman does not permit it on Shabbat. And with that, we finished 18th parak, Hadron Halach, Mifanim.